8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
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 How are you?
That really is from November, isn't it?
You're good.
Good. We're doing great.
All right. So let's dive in, because I already shorted you guys
it's
by
not,
a minute.
It's not really fair that we have like these inside jokes.
No, it's not.
It's not.
It's not fair at all. So,
let's
so anyway.
Move right into that.
Yeah, let's.
So our lead person in D.C. is planning a trip, I understand, to Africa.
Our unelected president, is that the guy?
You can say that.
Yeah. He's
going to go collect some tips from other dictators.
Well, no, he's going to go collect some tips from other people who've gained power by sham elections.
Yeah.
But we have George Bush going to 5 different African countries this week, and any number of newspaper editors and radio talk show hosts all over the country are rushing to their world atlases to find out where Africa is. And Bush is kind of the same way. They were mentioning on the Counterspin program just now how the much vaunted money for the AIDS program that Bush has promised, which is actually on a per capita basis, on a GMP basis, still way, way short of what most countries in the world are offering and what Africa is asking for,
a lot more than that. Yeah,
and even that money has not been appropriated and is likely not to be appropriated. So this trip is going to be mostly for symbolic gestures and photo ops, as most of George Bush's travel has devolved into being, and not a very careful examination of what U.S. foreign policy toward Africa has been. And we can certainly go into the long, long litany of countries across the continent where the U.S. has failed those countries or supported the most questionable forces within those countries. But we'll start with the one that is on the front page of the Seattle Times, although not the PI, this morning, and that is Liberia, which I think we put that on the list to talk about last week but didn't actually get to. Mm-hmm. Where a thug named Charles Taylor, who started a guerrilla war about 10 years ago, rose to power about 6 years ago on the basis of, among other things, kidnapping child soldiers, trafficking in weapons, enormous numbers of accusations of what are euphemistically known as humanitarian problems or human rights abuses. The UN actually unsealed a war crimes indictment against Taylor about a month ago for his assistance to rebels in neighboring Sierra Leone. And there's also been unrest in neighboring Côte d'Ivoire, is that how it's pronounced now? Ivory Coast, for those who didn't get the French transition in the past year. So he's been the president and chief massacre of the villagers for the past, 6 years now, I believe. And there's been a civil war for all of that time. As of last week, there had been 250,000 people in a country of only 2.5 million, a country that doesn't have a population. Actually, it's about the same size as King and Pierce County combined. And 250,000 people massed on the outskirts of the capital city of Monrovia. There is yet another very fragile ceasefire that's been in place this week. And all during that time and for the past several weeks, European countries, Nigeria, which is the power in Western Africa, and other African countries, and Kofi Annan, who comes from West Africa, he comes from the country of Ghana, have all been pressuring the United States to unleash what really would be not much more firepower than the city of Seattle or any major police force in the U.S. would have at its disposal. You don't need much to intervene with a peacekeeping force and stop Taylor's armed forces from unleashing massacres and creating the humanitarian crisis that's involved when you've got 250,000 people with no food, no water, no medical supplies. The precedent for this in the past year, both in Sierra Leone and in Côte d'Ivoire, the European powers that have been historically associated with those countries in Sierra Leone, Leon. It was originally founded. The capital city was originally founded by the British as a haven for escaped slaves. In Cote d'Ivoire was a former French colony, and Liberia is historically associated with the U.S. It was originally founded by freed American slaves. When they finally created the country in, I think, 1847 or something, it was modeled on the same Declaration of Independence that we had. It's always been very closely associated. And now Europe is looking at Africa and saying this model of having peacekeeping forces led by countries that are historically associated with and have credibility with the African countries has worked. The peace has been kept in both of the neighboring countries, in Sierra Leone, where there were also war crimes indictments, and in Cote d'Ivoire. But Washington, ironically enough, it's sort of a role reversal where all of these African countries, all of these European countries were dead set against the Bush adventurism in Iraq. Now they want Bush to take action in West Africa, and Washington has been utterly uninterested in doing so. And the headline in this morning's Times, actually, if you read the story, says it all. It's that Bush is going to send a military team that is going to investigate the logistics of American soldiers participating in a UN peacekeeping force. Well, that's several steps below what people in the country of Liberia, people in West Africa, and people throughout Europe and the UN have been wanting the U.S. to do. And the question rises, if the U.S. is going to self-style itself as the world's policeman, you can't have credibility in that role by picking and choosing which areas you're interested in, like the ones that have oil. You know, there are responsibilities, particularly for the countries that you're closely historically associated with. So Bush is going to hear an earful about that when he goes to West Africa. His first stop this week is Nigeria. And Nigeria alone has a lot of...
He's going to reach Nigeria on the 12th.
Now,
because of the strike, the general strike in Nigeria.
Oh, right, okay.
He's headed south. He's going to stop in South Africa.
Oh, he's going to do that first.
Yeah.
Okay.
South Africa, Botswana.
Talk a little bit about the strike in Nigeria? That's kind of a fascinating story, too.
Yeah, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because I could talk for a long time. But he was going to stop first in Nigeria to back up Olusegun Obasanjo, I think is how you pronounce his name. I might be wrong.
Yeah, the latest strong
arm. He was reelected recently in an election that the opposition party said was rigged. And international observers are not convinced that it was fair either. Obasanjo has been trying to get hold of the corruption in Nigeria. And corruption has been endemic in Nigeria for decades. Nigeria is the seventh largest oil exporter in the world. Their economy runs on oil, but a lot of that money seems to disappear somewhere, and nobody knows where.
And the Western oil companies, in particular the U.S., have a lot of influence there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's very, very little in the way of social services for the population. There's massive poverty in Nigeria. Nigeria has a very large population for a very small area. And the people who do get some social services tend to be centered around Abuja and Lagos, the two main cities. And the rest of the population is kind of left to blow in the wind. That's created a lot of ethnic tensions there. There's been a lot of ethnic tensions and tribal violence. And it has also created a problem in the southern part of the country where the oil production, where the oil extraction facilities are. A lot of the locals are really upset that they're suffering the environmental consequences of oil drilling and oil pumping, but not getting any social services from the government. So Bush was going to travel there to try and support Obasanjo and to try to get him to do a little bit more to provide social services for the country. He's under pressure from the IMF and the World Bank to pay foreign debts, and to do that, they have asked him to raise the price of gas in his country to market levels, which would make it about the same as it is here in the U.S. For a country where the poverty level is so high, that would put it out of reach of most of the population in a country that produces oil and exports it, but doesn't have any facilities to really refine it and supply its own gas. So they have to import gas in Nigeria. And so what happened was the Nigerian unions got together and said, well, we're going to go on a general strike until the government gives in and says, well, we won't raise the price of gas. And that general strike has been going on since Monday. It's still ongoing, and it's a security concern because Nigerian troops have fired live rounds on demonstrators in the street. Reportedly, four were killed in a town just outside of the capital. And there have been, you know, tear gas used pretty liberally in Lagos and Abuja. And there's some concern, I'm sure, among the Bush administration about George Bush flying into this volatile situation and drawing the international press to really look at what's going on in Nigeria. And so they've decided to bypass Nigeria and head instead for Southern Africa. And Bush is going to sit down at a little round table with businessmen in South Africa and talk about the economy of South Africa instead.
Yeah, and I would think that the risk there also is that increases the likelihood that the government in Nigeria is going to really fiercely crack down on the strikers this week before the international press arrives.
They've been trying to do that.
Right.
And the government has put a lot of pressure on the unions to come to some kind of agreement to raise the price of gas by some, you know, medium in between what the government wants and no increase. And it looks like that's actually going to happen, that that the unions might cave and go for some, you know, medium increase that will still have a profound economic effect on most of the residents of Nigeria.
Yeah, and there's also another whole area, and I don't want to spend too much more time on Africa because we have other parts of the world we have to get to.
Yeah.
One other thing to watch for in terms of the coverage that will not happen this week while Bush is in Africa, which is the arms deals that will probably flow from this visit and from the follow-up work by the various embassies, or consulates, I mean, in these different countries, and embassies, I'm sorry, in these different countries. All of the wars that are racking Africa, and there are some horrific ones. Congo, where millions of people have died, was it
3.3 million,
yeah,
more than have died in any war since World War II.
There's several others that are raging throughout sub-Saharan Africa right now. U.S. arms are arming many of the parties, not all of them, but many of them in many of these conflicts, and they're second and third hand off of the black market. But you've also got the syndrome of the U.S. really pushing hard to sell weaponry to many of these governments, many of these unelected governments, and they can do so because the IMF, in its structural adjustment programs for this country's exempts arms sales. I mean, governments can't spend money on basic social services in a lot of these situations like Nigeria.
A lot
where
of them borrow money to buy U.S. arms.
Yeah, and the U.S. underwrites their borrowing of the money in turn. So that actually is going to be one of the things that flows out of this trip that is not going to make the headlines as he goes through his various photo ops. So just be aware of that and all of the many stories on the continent that have not been reported, and after this week won't be reported again probably anytime soon.
All right. Well, moving on to other parts of the world that are in turmoil and that we have a hand in. Let's move to, seems like a regular feature now, This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, This Week in Iraq has been kind of interesting. At first I thought there wasn't much going on except an increase in guerrilla attacks, and they are guerrilla attacks. My first item on the list is on Sunday, The Guardian of London and The Observer, the Sunday version of The Guardian, reported that U.S. officials have found a document that details an Iraqi government emergency plan for looting and sabotage in the wake of an invasion, which was prepared by Iraqi intelligence. Now, this document is marked top secret, and it was circulated among Iraqi intelligence. It was basically details 11 kinds of sabotage, including burning government offices, cutting power lines, and attacking water purification plants. It was something that Iraqi intelligence was telling its troops to do in case Baghdad fell and the U.S. took power. This is what would be the next phase of the war. So it really, really does emphasize that what's going on right now is a guerrilla war, something that the U.S. military and the U.S. press seems to be completely unable to confront, face, or talk much about.
But it is a guerrilla war in that case by, if not people loyal to Saddam, people loyal to that people who participated in the planning of that past regime.
Mm-hmm. That's
right.
Does
that make sense?
That's right. Also, there was another great article that came out this week. I would really recommend that people go and look for it. The San Francisco Chronicle doesn't often print wonderful pieces of original investigative reporting, but they did this Wednesday. An article written by a man named Robert Collier detailed that a network of Kurdish smugglers has been exporting the looted goods from Iraq through Kurdish manned checkpoints in northern Iraq. The smugglers themselves are Kurdish businessmen, so wealthy Kurdish businessmen, and they have extensive contacts with the two main Kurdish resistance groups, the PUK and the DK, whose troops take bribes to look the other way as these goods, everything from copper bars melted down from the wiring that's stolen off of electrical pylons, all the way up to bulldozers and construction cranes that were used in the oil industry. Everything that's pretty much been looted has gone across the border in the Kurdish-controlled areas through Kurdish-manned checkpoints, and the Kurds are profiting from it. Now, I want to emphasize that it's not Kurdish smugglers who are doing the looting. This reporter made it very clear that they're buying them from the looters. They're buying these goods at a discount from the looters themselves. Now, given what I just told you about that Iraqi intelligence report, the looters seem to be former members of the Saddam Hussein regime, and they're actually using the Kurds to help them fund their guerrilla war, is what it appears to be happening.
So if I'm Rumsfeld, what I hear from this is that they're learning how capitalism works.
That's right. That's exactly
a free
right.
A free market economy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And the U.S. has had no troops and no interest in cracking down on these smuggling operations among our Kurdish allies. Now, also in Iraq, Operation Sidewinder kicked into gear this week. Now, in the past few weeks, it's been Operation Desert Scorpion, where U.S. troops have gone north and west of Baghdad doing house-to-house searches and sweeps through the so-called Sunni Triangle to try and find, you know, weapons caches and some of these guerrillas. And they didn't find very much. They found a few hundred AK-47s, some pistols, and a little bit of cash. Now they're thinking, okay, maybe we got the wrong area. Operation Sidewinder is moving from areas north of Baghdad east over towards the Iranian border and trying to tackle villages in those areas. And again, they're not coming up with very much stuff. It's looking a lot like Operation Desert Scorpion, house-to-house searches, a few rifles, a couple pistols, a little bit of cash, and that's all they're finding.
And they're taking this stuff. I mean, on what authority are they? Are they taking, you know, private property from these people?
Right. I mean, if it was happening here in America, you'd have an open revolt. Now, at the same time, guerrilla attacks have continued throughout Iraq, particularly in Baghdad, where they've not only become more frequent, they've also become bolder. Attacks are not coming in the middle of the night anymore. They're in broad daylight, and they're not just drive-by shootings anymore. In one case, it was a man on foot firing a rocket-propelled grenade into a U.S. convoy on a busy street in the middle of Baghdad during the day. And he got away. And he got away because, obviously, the Iraqi people are helping. They're sympathetic and they're helping, in spite of what you hear from military spokesmen in Central Command. The Iraqi people obviously sympathize with these guerrillas, and they're helping them out. Now, it also became clear this week that the U.S. is going to need more troops in Iraq to help with this problem. Now, that's just across the board. Everybody from the media to politicians to military analysts are agreeing that we need more troops.
Although people
Iraq.
Have been saying that for the last 3 months, though, haven't they?
I mean, yes, they have.
That there's no way you can have this occupation with the limited number of personnel that were deployed for it.
Yes, they have. But now the Bush administration is on board, and they're saying it, too. And the Bush administration is saying that they're going to try to get 20,000 troops from among allied nations to try and go over and help the U.S. troops that are there and maybe hopefully bring some U.S. troops home. Now, military analysts are saying that's peanuts. What we need is somewhere between 60,000 to several hundred thousand troops to really be able to start bringing some of our own troops home. But what the Bush administration has done is they will not go to the U.N. because France, Germany, and Russia were against the war, so they will not ask the UN for help. They will not go to NATO, because guess what? Germany and Russia play a big role in NATO. And so the Bush administration has been asking smaller countries one-on-one. They've gone to about 70 different nations, and only about 24 have said, okay, we'll send you some troops. And it's been little bits here and there, a few dozen from one country, a couple hundred from another.
Six from Latvia, three from Andorra.
Well, actually, 36 from Latvia.
Oh, okay. Oh, you've got the list.
I've got the list. Yeah, I'm not going to read the list, but it really is. The largest contingent is going to come from Poland. It's 2,300 soldiers. The second largest contingent is Ukraine with 1,800 troops. Now, a lot of these troops have no training in peacekeeping, like, for example, French gendarmes do have a lot of training in peacekeeping. So do German troops, got a lot of training in the Balkans. And so these guys are going to go over there. It's going to be an international force. They're not going to be deployed where U.S. troops are deployed. They're going to go mostly into a little enclave sandwiched between the British enclave in the south and the American enclave in the north, and they're going to police Najaf and Nasiriyah, and that's about it. There are probably going to be coordination problems with the different languages that these troops speak and their different trainings. A lot of these are going to be non-combat personnel. They're going to be medics and supply officers and so forth. And it's only a drop in the bucket. So far, those 24 countries have come up with a little under 9,000 troops, which is not even close to the 20,000 that the Bush administration has asked for, and nowhere near what military analysts say are needed. But here's the kicker. The Polish president told the press on Friday, some Western reporters asked him, well, why are you helping out with so many more troops than anybody else? And he looked right at reporters and he said, because we want access to Iraqi oil.
He said it outright. In other words, this is what the U.S. is promising to people in exchange for the troops.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it really does underscore how much the U.S. in this particular operation is an international pariah, that even with that out-and-out bribe, really, that the U.S. can't get any support for what it's doing in Iraq right now. Nobody will be willing to help, number one, because the U.S. had no legitimacy going in there in the first place, and number two, because it is now, shall we use the Q word out loud this week, a quagmire.
That's right, and some of the countries that could send many more troops, like India, could send a large contingent, but they won't because this war has not been sanctioned by the U.N., and they're hesitant to get involved in a war that was undertaken unilaterally by the U.S. and Britain.
Because, of course, that might open us up to international criminal court sanctions, right?
That's right.
All right. Well, let's move along. The other war that seems to have been forgotten in the media is in a place called Afghanistan.
Yeah, two developments there this week. There were reports that Mullah Mohammed Omar is reconstituting the Taliban and has appointed a new 10-member council. And in fact, the Pakistani newspapers that reported this could name many of the members of the council. That's how open it is in eastern Pakistan. However, the U.S. troops, some 7,000 U.S. troops based in Afghanistan who are supposedly still hunting the remnants of the Taliban, are having trouble finding them, although certainly the Pakistani press is having no trouble finding them.
And Mullah Omar himself, wasn't he like the most wanted person on the face of the earth, or second most wanted on the face of the earth?
Yeah,
and we seem to have forgotten him, just like we forgot bin Laden, just like we're, we have a $25 million reward out for Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, that's a joke. The U.S. has a reputation in Iraq of not paying salaries. Who's going to expect them to pay a $25 million reward? Anyway, so the other development in Afghanistan this week is that Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, became the first senior member Western politician to visit the city of Kandahar in southeast Afghanistan, which was the former base for the Taliban. And what he found there is that security...
The first since the war.
And security in that city and that region has been so bad. He found that the central government has no influence outside of Kabul, which is what the UN has been saying. Warlords rule, and many are fighting each other for territory and access to the black market in different regions. Law and order is the main concern of the people that he met with in Kandahar. individual rights there are a joke. Women are still wearing the burqa in most areas of Afghanistan outside the capital. Unemployment is very high. There are no public services in most parts of the country. That means no electricity, no water, no passable roads, no health care. And that opium production has skyrocketed, particularly in the area that he visited around Kandahar. Now, there are two reasons for that. First of all, Hamid Karzai doesn't have an army to deploy. He has to rely on international peacekeepers who are based only in the capital of Kabul. He has asked multiple times for them to be based outside of the capital, and he really needs the support of the U.S. and Britain for that, and they have said no because they're overstretched in Iraq already. So there's no way for the central government to keep the peace anywhere else in Afghanistan except in Kabul. And the second reason for that is that there's no money. Karzai was promised $5 billion by various donors. He's only received less than half of that, about $1.8 billion, and that money has disappeared into the maw of the various warlords in the region who take the money and then don't provide any services to their people.
Well, and you've got the U.S. giving the warlords directly money in order to keep them quiet and, have them rule the different parts of the country without directly targeting U.S. troops. And meanwhile, they're using some of that money to fight each other with civilians in the crossfire.
That's right.
All right. Very quickly, because we only have a couple minutes left, two other things I wanted to inject real quick was the I saw articles this week that Bush suspended military assistance to 35 countries because the countries refused to give immunity to the U.S. in the International Criminal Court. You just mentioned the International Criminal Court. Mm-hmm. And the other article I thought was interesting to be placed that came a couple days later was that he's also started the process of six detainees, some would call them POWs, for a military tribunal, which is the first.
And isn't it sad that that American media doesn't make linkages between stories like that? It's and you know it almost doesn't need any more comment than that. People can do it themselves.
And I mean the real thing here that you see is that the Bush administration doesn't support international justice. We support our own military tribunals. And we will violate the Geneva Conventions in order to do that.
Yeah, and people see the hypocrisy of the U.S. having one law for itself and another law for everybody else.
Well, we're not even following the tribunals. We're not even following our own laws.
Oh, no, I understand
That's right.
Which I know
but
you
we're,
do. But
we're making it up as we go along, basically.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And not to be reviewed by anyone because it'll all be so secretive. So.
Let's just give folks an update on our pledge call last.
Yeah, I wanted to do that before we before we finished up. We really really appreciated the folks who sent in money or called in their support. We got enough money to print, which was good for last time and for next time. Like 30 people sent in money, well over $1,000 directly from this show, which we really really appreciated. We will need more in the future, so if people didn't have a chance to or didn't get a chance to write the number or address down, the address for Eat the State donations is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145, and the phone number, area code 206-903-9461. We'll give that again in a moment, but I also want event I wanted to plug this week, Seattle Thunder, which is an offshoot of Rolling Thunder, being in town last summer. Today, a smaller version, but of the same sort of thing, with a lot of different activist groups and a lot of different good speakers, and Eat the State will be there, and I'll be on a panel there with Brian Drodowski and a couple other people. It's from 4 to 9 at St. Joseph's Church on Capitol Hill at 19th and Aloha. Again, Seattle Thunder, 4 to 9 at St. Joseph's Church.
Yeah, and unfortunately we're running out of time, so you won't really have a chance to give that info.
Oh, okay. Well, then
again,
never mind. Just
you can also visit our website at www.eatthestate.org.
Yeah, we're giving it all piecemeal this time.
All right. And, of course, one of the best ways people can give consistent support is to do a subscription.
Yeah. Absolutely. Again.
All right.
Box 85541-98145.